This is lesson number 10 in the series on scriptural principles of raising children. And our subject this morning is restricting your child. You remember that last week we discussed Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 6, which says, "Train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." This will be our text in the subject of restricting your child, because this word that is translated here, train up a child in the way that he should go, is a word that suggests restriction. Now, that's not all that it suggests. Matter of fact, last week we discussed the training, the discipline, and we pointed out that physical discipline, punishment, is required and is involved in training children. I see that someone has gotten the point of the lesson by drawing an illustration on the blackboard of a large paddle with some holes in it, which they call that Big Bertha. Physical punishment is required, but that's not the only way that we should use in enforcing discipline with our children or in training them. So this morning we want to concentrate on other means and other methods and talk about those for a little. Now it comes directly from the word that is used in Proverbs 22:6, the word train. And I have written that Hebrew verb on the blackboard. You read Hebrew from right to left, so the first letter that you read is a K sound, a CH sound, and then the N and then the K, kanak. And that word means literally to make narrow, to restrict. It's closely related to another Hebrew verb. If you just change the last letter, then you have the Hebrew verb which means to strangle, which would suggest to us that the verb that we have in Hebrews 22:6 is just a little bit short of strangling, but it is certainly has the idea of restriction and of restraining. It also has a positive aspect in its meaning, because it can also be translated to put something into the mouth to taste. And in some cases in the scripture, it is translated in that way. So it has both senses in the word, and we want to look at those in connection with raising children. Now, this word suggests, you see, then, that we should make boundaries for our children, that we should set limits in order to make narrow their way. And it suggests also that we should provide positive things for our children to do. We should put something into their mouths also that has the effect of limiting their way. Now, this is not a substitute for using the rod. Remember, we talked about that last Sunday. So what we're talking about is not a substitute means of discipline, but an additional means of discipline. It is biblical to use the rod, and it is biblical to use the method of restriction and narrowing. Now, what are some of the techniques that we can use in restricting or making narrow the ways of our children? This is something that is discussed in a very positive way in Scripture, and there's a verse of Scripture in the New Testament that would suggest this, one technique of doing this. Turn, for instance, to Galatians chapter 6 and verse 7. We see a principle here that can be used in applying the technique of restriction. Galatians 6 and verse 7 says, "Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, this will he also reap." Whatever you sow, you will reap. Now, that's a principle that has a very general application, and we understand that to mean that if we do certain things, there are certain consequences that follow, and we will suffer those consequences. It has a great application in truth in the spiritual realm, but also in the physical realm as well. And so one of the ways that we restrict our children is by allowing the application of this law. That is, that there are certain things that they do which will invoke certain consequences. And so we could call this the principle of natural consequences. There are natural consequences that follow as a result of disobedience or misbehavior. And those consequences will have the effect of applying discipline. An example of this, for instance, is the story of the prodigal son. You remember in Luke 15, the story of the prodigal son, about the son who came to his father and said, "I would like for you to divide the inheritance with me, and let me have my share now, and I want to go and live on it." Now, his father, in this case, didn't refuse him. He didn't say, "No, you can't have it. It's not time for you to have that inheritance." But he allowed him to have it, and he gave him his portion of the inheritance. Well, the result of this was that the young man went off to the city and began to live a life of revelry and lasciviousness. In a very short time, he had used up his inheritance, and he was in a desperate strait. He found that he was in a condition where he was not happy, but miserable. And it was his misery that eventually forced him to recognize that he was better off in the home of his father than he was in trying to live a licentious life. And so he came back to his father. Well, that, you see, he realized the natural consequence of his action forced him to recognize his need. And we should allow the law of natural consequences occasionally to have its effect with our children. I think an instance where this is particularly applicable is, for instance, in the area of the eating habits of our children. There are some parents who are very much concerned that their parents should eat. And it seems that they get involved in a kind of a continual game or a continual struggle with their children. They're nagging them all the time. "Now eat this and eat that and clean up your plate," and it's a continual thing. And it becomes, in some cases, a power struggle between the parent and the child. The child realizes that the parent is trying to force him to eat, and it's something that he really has control over himself. And he determines that he's not going to eat, and he makes it a power struggle with his parent to see who's going to win. And it becomes a very bad situation. Well, this is an instance, you see, where we might employ the principle of natural consequences. We don't really need to nag our children or try to force them to eat. If they're hungry, they will eat. The Lord has built into them an appetite and a need to be fed. It's every so often. And if we just allow nature to take its course, they will eventually become hungry enough to where they will eat. We're funny creatures, though, as parents. We think that we have to do something about them, and so we nag them and bribe them and punish them, and we try to get them to do follow our ideas on this. But if we would just say, "Well, all right, if you don't want to eat, you don't need to eat, but this is the time to eat, and if you don't want to eat, then the next time to eat is at the next mealtime, and you don't eat between now and then." And it may mean in some cases that they go to bed hungry, or that they will later on wish that they had eaten, and that may seem like a cruel thing. Johnny will come to us and say, "Oh, I'm hungry. My stomach hurts." And we'll be tempted. Well, we ought to relent and give him something to eat now. But that's the wrong thing to do. If you just stick to the rule that you laid down, say, "No, you said you weren't hungry, and it's not time to eat now. The next time to eat is breakfast, and I'm sorry, but you'll just have to suffer the consequences of that." You'll find eventually that will be far more effective than nagging or bribing or other approaches to the problem. So we need to remember that there are certain things that are built in and that we can use to in this principle of natural consequences. Then there is another means of restricting our children is by the principle of logical consequences, and this is very closely related to the principle of natural consequences. The difference is that in the principle of natural consequences, the punishment is built in. It's determined by the misdeed itself. It naturally follows. But in the principle of logical consequences, it's not built in. It's something that we have to do to structure the consequences to see that the consequences follow. And Dr. Naramore, in his book, incidentally, I'd like to recommend this book to you. This is one we have available in our library, and this was brought to my attention last week by Jane Jackson. And it's a very excellent book, Help, I'm a Parent, by Bruce Naramore. He points out some examples of logical consequences. A family has several children. Let's say, and they every time they have supper, and it's a job to round up the children, get them into the house for supper. Mother goes out and she yells to the children, says it's time for supper, it's time to come, and the children keep on playing. They hear her because they know that that's just the first call, and they can ignore that, and pretty soon she'll come looking for them. So eventually, the dragnet starts, and she and father have to go out and round them up and bring them in for supper. It becomes quite an operation. And the way to handle that by the principle of logical consequences is to tell them that you're not going to do that, that they're going to have to assume responsibility themselves to be present at mealtime. And that supper is going to be at 6 o'clock or whatever time you set for it, and that you will call them 5 minutes before time for supper, and it's their responsibility to hear and to come. And if they don't hear, they know when it's going to be 6 o'clock, they're still responsible to be there. And if they don't come, then they will have to suffer the consequences. That's when the meal is served, and if they miss it, they miss it. And if you apply that principle strictly and stick to it consistently, then they will learn that they have to assume that responsibility, and they will be there at supper time. Now, it might mean that they might miss a meal occasionally, and they will test you on it just to be sure that you really mean what you say. But if you show that you do mean what you say, and that the consequences are going to be suffered, then it will work. In our home, we had a principle that logical consequences that children didn't watch television during the week. While the school was going on, and they had lessons to prepare, there wasn't any television for them during the week. They had homework to do every night, and if they didn't have homework to do, then I wanted to know why they didn't have homework. But in our school, they did have homework. So they had something to do, and they had a job to do. They didn't have time to watch television. But they were allowed to watch television on the weekend, provided that they had done their homework and that they had kept up in school and they weren't behind. There wasn't work that needed to be made up during the week. And We apply that rule rather strictly, that there wasn't any television and that in order to have any television on the weekend, homework had to be done. Well, that principle worked very well, and they didn't like to miss television, and so they worked hard and they got their lessons done. Another way in which we might apply this, I think, is with older children. Of course, when children get to be teenagers, it's a little bit late to be applying the rod very, very much then. Well, I told you the example last week about a young mother with a problem of trying to discipline a 15-year-old boy who is a good bit bigger than she is. And when you reach that point, it's a little bit difficult to apply the rod, and you must use other techniques. Well, the principle of logical consequences or restriction is one of the things that can be used. Every teenage boy looks forward to the day when he can drive the family automobile. And when he's 15, he starts thinking about, well, he starts thinking about it long before then, as a matter of fact. But when he's 15, he really begins to anticipate it. When he's 16, he begins to expect it. And he's just waiting for the day when he can get his driver's license and drive the family car. Well, that's one of the things you see that you can apply. In order to drive a car, a person must be responsible, and he must prove, he must demonstrate that he is a responsible person. It's irresponsible as a citizen for us to have our children driving cars when they're not really responsible. And so if the 15-year-old boy or the 16-year-old boy is not responding to guidance from his parents in the way that he should, if he is not obedient to his parents, then the parents should tell him, well, now, you're going to want to drive a car here one of these days, and I'm not going to let you have the keys to my car unless you have demonstrated to me that you're capable of doing this and you're capable of showing the kind of responsibility that's required. So you better shape up and remember that I expect you to do certain things. Well, that is a principle that can be applied and that can be used. Another way that we can restrict our children is by the process of communication, just simply talking to them and finding out what their problems are and communicating to them our interest and our concern. And I think this is an area in which there is a great lack, because we live in days that are so busy and we have so many things to do, and it's easy for us to forget that our children need to have some of our time and they need to hear certain things from us. I can remember my own girls, every once in a while they would want to communicate something to me, and I would not show that I was giving the kind of attention that they expected, and they'd say, Daddy, you're not listening to me. And I would say, yes, I'm listening, and I would repeat just what they had just said. Because I was listening even though I didn't appear to be listening. Well, sometimes I didn't really hear. Sometimes I wasn't listening. When you live in a girl's dorm, when you live with a bunch of ladies, you can't listen to everything, you know. It's just too much. So there are times when you just have to turn it off, but there are times when you need to turn your ears on and listen, you know. And you need to, when those times come, you need to give them your attention and to show them respect and listen to what they have to say, and then communicate to them without being abusive or without being angry, without being showing your emotions in such a way that it scares them off. And allow them to communicate to you. Dr. Naramore has an example in his book that I would like to read to you concerning this, because I think it's an excellent example of the problem of communication. And this is the one he calls the high school prom. This is one that if you have girls, or if you have boys either, certainly you will have the time will come when you have to deal with this problem. Marilyn had just been invited to the high school prom. That evening, she cornered her mother. Mom, can I go to the prom? Mrs. Carson quickly replied, of course not, dear. We've told you before. We're Christians, and Christians shouldn't dance. But mother, Marilyn responded, and the argument began. Let's look at a better way of handling this common problem, Dr. Nearmore says. Marilyn, Mother, can I go to the prom? Mrs. Carson, tell me about it, honey. It's coming up soon now, isn't it? Marilyn, yes, and Bill asked me to go. Mrs. Carson, you kind of like him, don't you? Oh, Mom, I've only dated him 3 times. Mrs. Carson, I know. Let's talk about the prom. Well, I never get to go, and all my friends will be there. All your friends? Well, not everyone, but our church socials are so dull. Mrs. Carson, it seems like all the sharp kids go to the prom. Marilyn, not all, but most of them. Mrs. Carson, we've talked about dancing before. What do you think about Christians going to dances? Marilyn, I don't know, Mom. I know the problems, but everyone goes. And after more discussion, Mrs. Carson, I know you really want to go, but I just don't feel it's best to. But Mother, I know, honey, but let's try to think of something to take its place. I know it won't seem as great, but we could plan something. Marilyn, no, if I can't go to the prom, I don't want to go to do anything. Mrs. Carson, okay, I know how you feel. Several lessons can be learned from this discussion. Although Mrs. Carson had strong feelings, she respected her daughter's desires. This is hard to do. When we feel strongly about something, we want to tell others what we think. We don't feel like listening to their opinions. Mrs. Carson knew Marilyn wouldn't agree. Nevertheless, she was willing to listen. She was able to view things from her daughter's perspective. She knew the church socials were dull, and she didn't try to talk Marilyn into something she didn't want. She had also talked to Marilyn before. The best way to avoid a crisis on issues like dancing is to talk things over as your child's interests are developing. Mrs. Carson also controlled her feelings. She didn't get angry or try to condemn Marilyn. She didn't imply that Marilyn was spiritually inferior because she wanted to dance. She realized this was a normal teenage wish. When Mrs. Carson had to end the discussion, she did it in a kind way. She didn't put Marilyn down by saying, "That's just the way it is." She tried to give some valid reasons and suggest suitable alternatives. When Marilyn said she didn't want alternatives, Mrs. Carson didn't try to force one on her. That wouldn't have helped Marilyn. It would only relieve Mrs. Carson's guilt for depriving her daughter of the prom. Well, that's one way of handling the prom problem. And the prom problem is, I think teenage dances are a particular problem when you get to high school. And it's a problem because all of the children are involved. Everybody goes to these things, and your children are going to want to go along with the crowd, and they're going to want to participate. And it's very difficult for you to communicate to them at that particular point what it is specifically that's wrong with these dances. Well, one approach to the thing, I think, is to apply the principle of logical and natural consequences to a certain extent. Let them know what your position is. And if your children are mature and you feel that they have their feet spiritually on the ground, let them go to some of the dances. Let them find out what it's like. Let them make their own judgment. And let them come to their own conclusion. This was the course that we followed with our children. We didn't forbid them to go to the dances that they had in high school. And they went to some of them. And they were able to see in themselves that there were certain elements of these things that were not good, not desirable, and they were able to make a judgment, and eventually they made the right conclusion themselves. So I think that is one way of handling this sort of problem. But the important thing to observe here, I think, is that there is a need to communicate and a need to communicate that you are willing to be communicated with. If we just talk to our children and try to find out what the problem is with them, what it is that's bothering them, or what it is that makes a difficulty, what it is that they're concerned about, oftentimes that is the root of the problem right there. And that is one of the means that we can use to restrict, to narrow their behavior. Now, you may think that that is a very gentle way and a very passive way, maybe. And yet, it is a way that can be very effective, because when they know how you feel and they can disassociate that with some strong emotional thing, and they see that there is conviction behind what you're saying to them and some reason. I mean, they may not understand it all at once, but eventually they will understand it better and better. That will have an effect upon their behavior. And of course, you have to depend upon that approach when they reach the point where they're going to college. When you send your children away to one of the universities, and it doesn't matter very much which university it is, even if it's a Christian school, when your children go away from home and they are on their own and on a university campus, at that point they are on their own, and whatever convictions they have are going to determine their behavior at that point. It's impossible at that point for you to restrict or control their actions. And they are going to decide at that point whether they're going to follow in the Christian way or whether they're going to follow in the way that's completely opposed and completely hedonistic. And that's what you see on the college campuses today. If you're a Christian on the college campus and you're going to live as a Christian, people are going to know it, and you're going to be in a group that is apart from the great majority of the students on the campus, because most of the students are they may have been brought up in Christian homes, but if there's not real conviction there in their own hearts, they're not going to follow their Christian beliefs. But if you have trained them in a way that so to develop real conviction there, and if real conviction has developed, then they will follow in the right way. Our children went to the University of Texas at Austin, and I don't suppose there is any university campus anywhere where you could be more exposed to the materialism and the attractions of this world and all sorts of things, but they maintained their convictions. They followed in a Christian way. They associated with other Christians on the campus, and their college experience was a great blessing and a spiritual advance for them. They developed spiritually while they were on the campus of the University of Texas. So I know that it can be done, and I know that it's not necessary that your children, even in their university days, should be completely sheltered and protected from every influence of the world. Your object really should be that you want them to be able to choose the right things on their own. Now then, let's look at another aspect of this word that we're considering, the word to make narrow or to restrict. And this other aspect is the positive aspect, the meaning that derives from the meaning it has to put something in the mouth to taste. This suggests that we should provide positive guidance and alternatives for our children. Every child who is growing up should be given some responsibility and some work to do. And he should do this work not just as a reward, not because you hire him to do it, but because it's part of his responsibility in the home. Now, the reason for that is that that is a positive means of narrowing his way and teaching responsibility. And one of the problems I think that we are faced with in the present day in our society is that there are so little things that we can that children can do to work. It used to be when people lived on farms, and there is all kinds of work to do, and there are so much to do that everyone has to work and everyone has a responsibility, and even small children have some responsibility to carry out on the farm. Well, we don't have all of those activities going on living in city life, and it's unfortunate that we don't. But even in our homes, if we make an effort to give certain responsibilities to our children, then it will be very helpful to them. Now, in a lot of cases, you find it doesn't really save you any work. In fact, when you start on this job, it just makes more work for you. The small girls want to do the dishes when they're small, and when they're too young really to be able to do it. They're not able to be any help. When they get a little older to where they can really be helpful, then they don't want to do it. But the proper approach, I think, is even when they're small and they have problems and they have difficulty in doing it, take the time to help them and let them get involved in it and to do the work, because it does teach them responsibility, and it will not be long until they learn to be able to do certain things themselves, and that gives them something to do. So we really have to exercise ourselves, and we really have to think about things for our children to do in living in the city. I think music is a good thing. If your children have musical talent, musical ability, it's a great thing to get them involved in music, because that takes a lot of time, a lot of effort, and a lot of practice. It is a discipline in itself, and that discipline will be helpful to them. Now, again, it's not something that you can just say, well, now, Mary, I'd like for you to take piano, and so I want you to go down every Saturday afternoon, take piano lessons, and then learn to play the piano. If your children get involved in music, you're going to find that it requires effort on your behalf. In our family, we had two girls, both of whom loved music. They wanted to play the piano. They came to church, and I think the thing that they really saw more than anything else was the lady that was playing the piano. Now, we didn't know that. We weren't aware of that until we observed that when they played church at home, the thing that they did that they wanted to do when they played church was to play the piano. And they did a wonderful imitation of the lady who played the piano at church. Well, very early they had an ambition to do this. And they had some talent also. So we started them out and began to give them lessons as soon as we thought that they could take it and work at it. But, you know, even so, it required discipline and it required training. And my wife spent many hours over the piano encouraging them and restricting them and enforcing a little bit of practice so that they would stick with it. And that is required, I think, in order to do that. Athletics is a great thing for the boys, of course, and I think athletics would be good for the girls, too, to a certain degree, and to whatever extent that they have interest in it. If they have interest in athletics, encourage that, because it's something that they can do that will require discipline on their part and require responsibility. And it will keep them out of a lot of other things that would be bad to them. In the area of providing positive guidance, of course, we talked about communication and the importance of talking to your children, but I think that there also needs to be some activities where you just sit down and read to them. Your children should be trained at an early age to enjoy reading. And this is something that has to be learned. If you don't ever read to your children, they're not going to learn to enjoy that. And it's a lot easier, of course, just turn them loose and say, now, there's the television, you can watch that. But they will not really enjoy that as much as you sitting down and reading a story to them or reading something that is profitable, because that involves your attention and your time. There are some wonderful children's books that every parent should read to their children. Winnie the Pooh is a book that you will enjoy as well as your children, and you can read it to them at an early age. Tom Sawyer, Pilgrim's Progress is a book that you should read to your children. Treasure Island, our children just love Treasure Island, and they still remember my reading Treasure Island to them. Now, Treasure Island is not just an entertainment, of course. It's not a book that is going to teach them a great deal in a spiritual way, but it is a means of communication. It's a means of getting their attention, and you're talking to them, and they're listening to you, and it's something that they enjoy. Now, you will also want to be giving them positive guidance about their future, and this is something that should not be delayed until their teenage years. Put something in their mouth early in this area of guidance about their future. I simply do not understand why parents will allow their children to come to the teenage years, and it's time for them to go to college, and you ask those children, where are you going to college? And they may say, well, I've been thinking about this place or that place, and I don't really know. What are you going to major in college? What is your interest? Why are you going to college? I don't know. I'll find out. I haven't made up my mind. I'll find out once I get there. Well, that's a tragedy, really, because your children, you are the one who knows them. You have watched them, and you've been lived with them from the time they grew up, very little children, and you know what their interests are and what their desires are, and if you have given them some guidance along the way and put the right kind of suggestions in their minds, when they get to be teenagers, they're going to know, they're going to have a pretty good idea of what they want to be. And you say, what is it that you want to be? I'm going to college. I'm going to study law. I'm going to be a dentist. I'm going to be a doctor. They know what they're going to be. And you should aim for that with your children. I do not believe in the principle that you just leave a child to grow up and he'll decide what he wants to be. No teenage child has the maturity nor the mental ability to be able to make that kind of decision on his own. And if you just leave it to him, you're doing him a great injustice, and you're missing a great opportunity. He needs guidance, and he needs it from very early years. So don't think that that's something that you should just leave to him. Now, you can't be tyrannical about it, of course. You have to give him some opportunity for his expression and his desires, but there should be some positive guidance on your part along the way. Well, does this sort of discipline work? Does this sort of restriction really work with children? My experience is that it does work. You read a lot of books about training children, and some of them take the approach that it's a matter of applying behavioral psychology, and they apply the same kind of principle to raising children that you would to training an animal or training something that has no intelligence at all. Do you know how they train a falcon? You ever heard how they train a falcon? It's a very difficult process to train a falcon. You've heard about how falcons that rest on your arm, and you take them out in the field, and you turn them loose, and they fly out, and they will capture a rabbit or another bird or something and bring it back. How do you train a falcon to do that? Well, I don't know all of the details. I don't know how they everything that they do, but I know how the training starts. When you get ready to train a falcon, the first thing that you do is you take that falcon and you pick him up and you put him on your arm. And he's supposed to sit there. And of course, the falcon's not, he doesn't know that, and he's not going to do that. So the falcon immediately will hop off of your arm and hop down to the ground. Well, then you pick him up again, you put him back on your arm again. And you do that repeatedly, and this process may go on for as long as 8 or 10 hours. But if you stop, if you give up before that falcon does, you will never train that falcon. Well, you see, what they're doing there is they're applying the principle of behavioral psychology. You just continually work on that and just persist at it. And to some degree, this principle applies with children, but we really don't want to train our children like falcons are trained. We don't want to have to just be continually after them and continually saying, well, now you must do this, and then just following them around everywhere they go to be sure that they do the right thing. Training of children has to have an effect on the mind. You have to reach them with some sort of intelligence so that they see the logic of it and that they're trained in that way. So that's the sort of training that we're aiming at. So it does involve teaching. It has to involve restriction, and it has to involve discipline. And the only alternative to that I see is the technique of behavioral psychology, just continually hammering on them and gently forcing them to go in a certain way. But that's the biblical way, is that you apply discipline and you do it consistently and you do it in a way that leads to the proper training. And I think that is really what is comprehended in Proverbs 22:6. Train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. It involves both a negative and a positive aspect. It involves making his way narrow by certain restrictions. It involves providing alternatives, and then also it involves discipline. Now then, perhaps I've raised some questions in your mind, or perhaps there are some things that you can contribute to this discussion that we've been having this morning about restricting and training. We have about 5 minutes left in our lesson, so are there some particular problems, or are there some things that you would like to say in this connection? What has been your experience in restricting your children and training them in this way?
When you say that you restrict your eating hours, but now how do you get around the fad of what they eat?
Well, if you restrict their eating hours, then they eat what you eat. They eat what is there at the table and what you serve.
Just let them eat what they want that's on the table.
They eat what they want that's on the table within certain limits. They don't eat all of just this and none of this. There are certain things that they must eat.
And then the fat comes in.
Well, there are some things that children don't like. They don't like to eat. But little children, for instance, I've noticed that our grandchild loves bread, particularly rolls and honey. And it doesn't matter what else we have at the table, if we have hot rolls and butter and honey, and she gets started on that, that's all she wants. So they have to say to her that none of that until she's eaten some meat and vegetables, and then she has the rolls and the honey. And she doesn't start with the rolls and the honey and get involved in that before she eats some of the other things.
Okay, so what do you do where there's some food textures that gag your child? And not only do they lose that, they lose everything else that they have taken prior to that.
Well, we never forced our children to eat things like that. There are some food textures that perhaps they will gag on, but there are some that they won't. Certainly that's desirable.
They can't gag on anything they want to.
Yeah, that's true.
It's not the food, it's their desire.
Well, have you tried saying, well, all right, perhaps you're not hungry. If you don't want to eat, then you don't have to eat. But this is what there is available, and if you want it, this is what you eat.
Could you explain to me what is wrong with dancing?
Well, I guess I'm going to have to show how old-fashioned I am here. If you talk about dancing and the type of dancing that's done nowadays, where it's a boy over here doing something and girl over here doing something else, and there's no contact between the two of them, if you look at what's going on, it's a lot of sensual movement, suggestive movement. And that, if they're exposed to that for several hours, that's bound to have an effect. It's bound to condition their minds that along certain things. Now, when I was a teenager, I didn't see anything wrong with dancing either. I loved it. I thought it was great. I couldn't understand what my parents could see in dancing that was harmful, because I wasn't aware of anything that was harmful about it. But the kind of dancing that we did when I was a teenager was the kind, not where you were, boy and girl were doing something separately and there wasn't any contact, but we were in pretty close contact with each other and moving around together. And I don't think that it was in itself necessarily harmful, but it can be suggestive and it can be provocative.
This is modern jazz is very good for your body as far as the exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and yet that's very.
So is jogging.
suggested, and yet it's good. And but I've never really known the real reason.
Well, it of course depends upon where it's done and how it's done, but where is it ordinarily done, and what is the type of music that they're exposed to? Have you listened to some of the music that they and the words that are involved? Those songs are just.
Of course, it would depend on the situation. That I can see. It
would depend on the situation, but I think in some cases the music that's involved, that they're dancing to now, is, and the songs are just horrible. Well, you listen to some of those songs and listen to the words of them, see what they're saying. They're just full of suggestions to use drugs and that sort of thing.
Howard, I think, if I may, the problem exists between the difference, the approach of the woman and the man, or the boy and the girl. It may not be provocative at all to the female, but it is to the male.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the little girls don't know.
That's right. They don't realize it.
Unless you tell them. This same thing about female the clothing that women wear.
Yeah, they don't realize that.
To the women, it's no problem.
Yeah. They don't realize the effect that it's producing. They're not aware of it. Yeah.
Something that is just really totally shocking. If parents haven't, you know, parents can go and visit a junior high school and they just see kind of what's on the surface. But I know this year, I guess I'm kind of numb at this point, but the language that is used with these 7th and 8th graders is just really unbelievable. I mean, they will say anything, just anything. And that goes right along with, you know, I get stuck every once in a while having to sponsor a social. And they make the most suggestive movements you have ever seen in your life. They just, it's, you know.
And their language
goes right along with it,
doesn't it?
And it just, there's nothing they hold back. Absolutely nothing.
There's no such thing anymore as a dirty word as far as they're concerned.
They will say any word that comes in their head. Any word. They'll say it to the teacher sometimes.
Yeah. Let's, over here. Yes, and I think that's one of the things that ought to be controlled. That's one of the areas where we need to restrict. We need to know who our children are with, who their companions are, and what sort of people they are, because that leads to trouble. One of the techniques that I often used with our children was that I told them, now, when you're out with some other kids, and they want to do something wrong, something that you know is wrong, and you get involved in it, 9 times out of 10, if trouble develops out of this, you're the one that's going to get in trouble. And that's usually the way it works. If a Christian kid is out with a bunch of unsaved kids, and they get involved in something that's wrong, and they get caught, it's the Christian kid that gets in the trouble, usually, because he doesn't know how to protect himself. He doesn't know how to avoid the trouble the way the unsaved kid does, and he's the one that gets caught. And I told my girls this. I said, now, you just watch and see. You'll find that you're the one that gets caught. So you need to be extra careful. You need to be very diligent to be sure that you don't get involved in these kinds of things. And sure enough, and I'm very thankful I had the experience. One or two times this sort of thing did happen. It wasn't a real serious thing, fortunately, but it was something that some misbehavior that they were involved in with other children, and they were the ones that got caught. And I said, no. And I pointed out to them, I said, no, you see, that's the way it works. So you can just expect that. Well, that's something you can use.
3 hours on music and dancing. And if you haven't been to the Bill Gothard seminar and you're concerned about dancing, he gives an awfully good answer. And you can't do it in 5 minutes. But scripturally, he can back up why it's bad. And I think that's important.
Thank you. I haven't heard that lecture, so I'm not aware of it. There is a principle: abstain from the appearance of evil, and abstain from all evil. 1 Peter. And this is a principle that that I think comes to bear in this. 1 Peter 2:11, beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lust, which war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing which they slander you as evildoers, they may on account of your good deeds as they observe them glorify God in the day of visitation. So we're to abstain from fleshly lust, We're to abstain from the appearance of evil. We're told in other places.
And in 1 Corinthians 15:33, do not be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals.
Right.
Selected sure. At any level. Why is that necessarily intimidating? That's my problem. Well, it isn't, you know, a ping pong with a bad bunch is a bad thing.
That's right.
It's difficult for people who want to corrupt people who are ping pong oriented. It's not music because they use rhythm as a basis, and rhythm is very difficult for a child.
Dominant force is good.
Right.
But
that's what I'm
the
saying.
Music that
the teenage oriented music, yes, I can see that, but I can't say that as a blanket.
It brings the sexual things to the forefront.
I can understand that.
Yeah, it's not quite
that's what I'm saying.
Mrs. Jackson.
About every aspect of his life, the Lord is going to give him the wisdom to choose, and the child will choose regardless. You say a 13-year-old may not be strong enough, but if they're a Christian and they have a strong prayer life, the Lord will give them the wisdom. And these things will slowly, if the child will pray, Lord, give me the wisdom to choose, give me the desire, let it be taken away, but the Lord will do this. And these things, so many of them will just fade away because the Lord has taken the desire away.
That's right.
And he will give them the wisdom to choose. And it will be no problem.
That's the subject of our lesson next week, is praying for your children and praying with your children, and is really one of the ways in which we can restrict or make narrow their way. So that'll be our lesson, subject of our lesson next week. Shall we close now in prayer? Our Father, we thank thee for thy goodness to us and for the gift of thy word. We pray that thou will give us understanding in it, and understanding in knowing how to lead and to direct our children. For we pray in Jesus' name, amen.